Basil. This is Montez Press in the house. Woo! We got a party tonight. Boat party, boat launch party for our new book, On the Rocks by Jerzy Skierczy.
On the Rocks, our newest publication in the number of our calendar, releases our
That is it.
Montez Press, formed 2012. Publishes texts against current critical modalities and theoretical dogmas. The literature informs the contemporary knowledge economy by expanding text into sound and image. On the Rocks, our newest publication in the number of our calendar, releases our multi-constructions which work to dislocate current critical assumptions and structures.
Bang is an artist, writer and chef investigating technique, habitus, and recognition. Line Type is visual design studio. The motivations of the studio are to operate in and antagonize the questions of drawing and mediated representation. Lovely Little Hostages, our upcoming calendar release, is an infatuation that lingers on despite separation, anxiety, and time travel. A.M. Bang lays down the structure while Line Type maps visual and sonic landscapes. They cruise Japan, the result is a tangle of words. Prose hiding in poetics, floating through train stations, volcanic sunsets, love hotels, tea ceremonies. All made available in your very own private karaoke box. The narrative illuminates the paradoxes and pleasures of uncharted territories in time, geography, and relationships. Love in colors.
Fishnet stockings. It's just before the heat of the day begins to wear off. Still oppressive, the sun beams, beating into thick clouds. It rounds up against the congestion of molecules in the air. It's just about to break. I think, just as I think it will transform into rain, the cool air of evening begins to penetrate the cloud layer. Openings form and a release is made. I know it's time for them to come for me. I am ready. He moves closer and I resist, but only fleetingly. The wicker basket is cool and dark. All 12 of us are waiting, ready, our feathers plucked in customary fashion. The first show is the most difficult. The boat begins to sway back and forth. It's taking too long. I'm getting anxious. We all sift uncomfortably. Not long now, not long now. The sun is going behind the clouds, the last light of evening fading, people clamoring onto boats. I hear the crackling of wood, the metal cage being raised. The fire is lit, the lines are drawn. The friction between the layers of his grass skirt stills me. The rustle fills my heart with palpitations. Is this what it means to be broken? At least I know I'm going to get my fix. The thrill of it all. with his grass skirt brushes behind the confines of my dressing room. Soon he will come to tie the knots, tie the noose around my neck. Not too tight, and my movements become slow. Too loose, and I get gluttonous. Consuming so many little fishies, my bowels will burst. Tied to my costume, tied to my custom, tied to my tradition. His hand is still cool, wet now as it slides down my neck. Out I come, noosed, each of us placed in position. The fire is burning bright, too hot. We are all banded together in his hands, webbed to his fingers, orchestrated strings, ready for command. The moisture, thick now, picks at our feathers, tries to burrow its way in with the paparazzi lights. I feel a moment of stage fright. That moment we first pop off the boat, disembarked. It's showtime. The wooden mallet stick, the wooden sides, slap, slap, slap. The nooses are tightened one by one, our bodies given tender stroking, a reassuring send-off. I need no other cue. The silky water, its green, murky substance turned to glass by the calming of night. My jet-black body pierces the tension line. The hunt has begun. We work as a pack of wolves speeding through the magnetic field that is the blue marine. The comfort in repetition of performance has taken over, the back and forth. The back and forth of the water, the rope, my body, fighting all the time against it. Fighting to be free, fighting to consume. Back and forth, my constant fight for progression and progress and the tightening of my costume and the rope until I am too full. All the life I could breathe in one breath, and I'm suddenly back on board, the contents of my efforts stolen from the inside of my mouth. It all happens so quickly. I am engulfed in the glitter of boat lanterns, the snapping of cameras, the heat of the fire. The release of this heat in cooking, chewing, lasting into the end of the night, only to be dropped right back down again. The line goes slack. The others move in different directions. I feel about, looking paralyzed, my dressing gown down around my knees. I hesitate only to realize that the flaming cage of logs was right above my head. Embers scorching my black feathers, hot, quick, burning embers crackling overhead. The loose pieces falling into the water all around me. My wings, finally, finally, on fire.
Is a writer and artist based in Berlin. She studied at Hochschule der Bildenden Kunst, Hamburg and Goldsmiths, London. In 2010, she founded Young, Fresh and Relevant, a journal which focuses on writing by artists. She is currently part of the editorial team of Call, a zine on art and feminism. Summer's short story that she contributed to our calendar PDF series early this year.
This, perhaps, was not so intelligent on our part. There was a heat wave on a uniform of high-waisted denim shorts and spaghetti strap camisoles did not offer many hiding places. I'd never known London so hot. The government initiated a hosepipe ban, the first since my childhood, and all around us, the grass withered and turned brown. Although, during my commute to work, I couldn't help but notice that in Primrose Hill, the flowers were flourishing. Until then, I had always enjoyed taking the underground, but now it became an ordeal to be overcome. 2 hours of my day were spent enduring the heat. We were packed so closely together that I could smell the shampoo of the other commuters, and the humidity was such that by the time I got off, it was possible to read the daily paper from the skin of my arms. I'd been so much more optimistic when I first got the job. "Think of how many books I'll get through," I exclaimed to anyone who would listen. In actual fact, I never had enough space or leverage to be able to read properly, so I mostly just stared at the ground, swaying unhappily. But even when the carriage was emptier, it wasn't any better. There was, at this time, a spate of strangely themed blogs gaining attention in the media, sites where people would upload surreptitious mobile phone pictures of commuters. When I found a blurry photograph of myself taking a bite out of an apple on Women Who Eat on the Tube, I completely freaked out, flinching every time I heard an iPhone. The tube had become unbearable, so instead I bought a bike, a metallic green single speed, which was beautiful but just rusty enough to stop it from becoming a target of bike theft, and every day I would cycle to work. After arriving in North London exhilarated and red-faced, I would head to the Pret-a-Manger around the corner from the gallery, because although I could never afford to buy more than a miso soup there, I had managed to befriend some of the staff, and they pretended not to notice when I used a bathroom to brush my hair and to put on my face. This was a routine I had adopted after the time I showed up to work and the director of the gallery asked me, "Did we call to work this morning, Deborah?" In her mid-60s, Sandra Mayer possessed the kind of face that led people to comment, "She must have been so beautiful once," as if it was a compliment. Quite a successful model as a teenager. There were some excellent photographs of her online, the perfect 50s housewife in striped dresses and full skirts selling toothpaste, soap and washing up liquid. She now looked so at home in her trouser suit that I suspected she might be sewn into it. Under her jacket, she wore a stiff white shirt cut in a V that showed her tan chest, which she accessorized with a big necklace that one of the assistants once made the mistake of commenting on. "A statement necklace?" she had retorted. "I don't know what you're talking about. Do you think I open a gallery to let my jewelry do the talking for me?" Divorced from a textile manufacturer, it was debatable whether she was a self-made woman or not, but she had successfully transitioned from beautiful to formidable, so that was something. In any case, Sandra Mayer was a woman for whom money had long ceased to be a major consideration. I wasn't being paid for my internship, and no one seemed particularly concerned with how I was supporting myself in a city where rent was fast becoming obscene. The other girls were art history graduates, educated at St. Martin's, the Courtauld, and Sotheby's Masters program. They were all intelligent with shiny hair, mouths rimmed with fashion-forward lipsticks in colours like Mirage and Show Orchid, and a uniform of neoprene, silk and crepe from directional Scandinavian brands. It was a shock to me. Who'd have known that there were so many different shades of navy? In this world, all the qualities that had made me popular at art school, humour, charm, an envy collection of novelty baseball caps, and a northern accent, meant nothing. One of the girls, Rebecca, second name also Maya, not a coincidence, had such a deep plum voice that I kept expecting her to purr, "Are you looking for a good time?" at any given moment. It felt like being a part of a very specific niche pornography film catering to men who get off on pretty young girls doing administrative tasks. They would send me emails to ask me to do things despite the fact that I was sitting in the same room. They started to appear in my dreams. I woke up tired, stressed, and bored from spending whole days in the gallery in my sleep. But what can I say? I had just graduated and it felt like progress. I more often than not arrive back home to find a correlation of friends sitting out in the garden, inevitably pink-skinned from sun exposure. They'd scrambled all at once to tell me how little they had done and how much they had drunk. It amused me to think about how many qualifications they had between them as they sat there sipping rum and ginger beer, the kitchen sides a mess of breadcrumbs, empty bottles and discarded lime wedges, and all the knives we owned sticky with citrus or greasy from chorizo and cheese slicing. It was the summer that methadone was still legal and being sold online as plant food, and two of the boys I lived with were selling it for £15 a gram to twitchy first years. That's how we found Gabriella. Her boyfriend, a slouchy, dark-eyebrowed Parisian, who we all kind of fancied but found completely humourless, showed up one day to buy a couple of grams, and because he'd been involved in some kind of socialist workers' party in France, he'd been thought of as interesting enough to be invited to stay and join in the afternoon's festivities. After that, he was usually around the house when I got back in the evening, and soon so too was Gabriella. Skinny like a prepubescent girl, her ugly pageboy haircut and oversized metal glasses did almost nothing to disguise her beauty. I was always pleased to see her. She was an artist herself and sympathetic to the problems I encountered in my working day. Evil, 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 take no notice. You will fly so high above these people that soon they will be no more than tiny dots. Really, I know it to be true. Just you wait, you will see. Who couldn't fail to be charmed by someone who spoke in such absolutes? While Matteo usually spent entire evenings in intense conversation with one person, Gabriella gave the impression of being everywhere at once, changing the music, preparing snacks, dancing, reading, speaking rabid French to her family on the phone, and mangled but intelligent English to the rest of us. Like all the French people I've met, she was ferociously well-read, always carrying well-thumbed paperbacks in her coat pockets. Despite her lofty reading habits, her artwork, which she showed me one evening on her battered laptop, was strangely bodily. There was a generosity to how she spoke of her own work and the work of others, but as well being generous with her time and energy, she was also constantly bringing over little gifts, books that one of us might find interesting, or nice French coffee and biscuits. One day, I came home to find the boys inexplicitly not home, and Gabriella, Sophie, and Rachel in the front room with the blinds half drawn, trying on clothes. Gabriella was wearing a high-waisted denim shorts and a skin-tight body with a scoop neck and another deeper scoop at the back. She really was very beautiful. Everyone was drinking sparkling wine, a new trend since Gabriella's arrival, and before I poured myself a glass, I twisted the bottle around out of habit to read the label. "Real champagne," I commented. "Is it someone's birthday? We got a good deal. Hey, I got this today, but it's not my color. I think it would look good on you." Pinching each shoulder with her thumb and forefinger, Gabriella held out a purple shirt towards me. I went to change and looked at myself in the mirror before going back downstairs. It really did look good on me. Poverty and daily bike rides had made my body leaner than it had been since I started university. After checking with Gabriella a few times to make sure she didn't want to just exchange the t-shirt for another colour, I gleefully ripped out the labels. Exactly 7 days later, I arrived at Gabriella's place for the first time after being invited for dinner. If Sophie hadn't already told me offhand earlier in the week that our new friend was a habitual shoplifter, I'd have been more surprised than I was when I entered the house. One of those big Georgian townhouses, it was unusually still one house, rather than being carved up into flats, and although sparsely furnished, remained in good repair. Gabriella's room was downstairs. Technically, it was the basement, but it still had sunlight on the ground floor, as the ground floor was higher than the street entrance. Basically one big room with a kitchenette and a tiny bathroom stuffed with products, she more or less had her own apartment. I was convinced there was some kind of deal going on. I couldn't believe that someone lived with one other person in a house built originally for an entire family and a couple of servants, while I lived in a rundown shack with five other people and was thankful for it. When Gabriella excused herself to go and finish preparing dinner, I took off my coat and tried to remain detached when I looked around the room. Apart from the books, which filled an entire bookshelf, there wasn't very much by way of furniture. Her bed was a mattress directly on the floor, covered with white sheets and a homemade-looking blanket. Other than that, a full-length mirror wrapped in fairy lights, a trestle table used as a desk, a square breakfast table already set for dinner, and some framed pictures on the walls. I ran my fingers along the spines of the books, a mix of French and English novels, some theory, and lots of artist monographs. I picked a few out at random, opening them but not really looking. Borrow anything you want, Gabriella said as she came out from the kitchen. She was holding two plates filled with meat, which she also placed on the table and proceeded to top up with salad. The food was simple but good. We washed it down with two bottles of red wine, followed by Japanese whiskey, the first time I had ever tried it, and it tasted marvellous. We talked easily about art and film, the differences between France and England. I found her as engaging and as open as the times we had seen each other at my place. It turned out that the apartment belonged to a friend of her mother. In exchange for not paying any rent, she did some shopping and had dinner with the woman a couple of times a week. Gabriella also revealed that she never paid for trains either, instead hiding herself in the toilet cabin. She occasionally changed which one she used in order to avoid suspicion. The girl was living an entirely cash-free existence, a real-life, modern-day bohemian. The next day, I found myself in front of a stand of notebooks at a stationer. Prohibitively expensive, I get a similar feeling when stroking the leather cover of a moleskin than I do touching the aluminium of my laptop. I went for one of the classic notebooks, a soft cover fixed with a band of elastic. After a cursory glance behind me, I just slipped it into the back pocket of my shorts and left. Presenting this prize to my flatmates when I got home, I was informed of what I by now suspected. Of course, they had already begun without me. We started with nail polish, something that I rarely wore but often envied on the fingers of others, as well as eyeliner and lipsticks, small things that were slipped easily into pockets. Then came American Apparel. You know, at the start they wanted people to steal from them, Sophie told me as we made our way back to the store. We were walking slowly and passing back and forth a can of Sal Pellegrino lemon between us, which we convinced was the only way to keep cool and hydrated in the heat. Sure they did. Really, she said. Think about it. The artists and the musicians who can't afford the clothes steal them, and then everybody else buys the clothes because the artists and the musicians have them. I could feel my shoulders starting to feel uncomfortably warm. Maybe I was burning already. I tentatively prodded my left shoulder and it felt hot to the touch. I guess that makes some kind of sense, I said. It was much too easy. We walked around the shop, picking out a couple of things. We were careful to maintain conversation with each other as we looked, a trick I had learned trying to get into clubs at 16 years old. When I had a pile of clothes, I went into the upstairs changing room and stuffed some of them into my rucksack. I got a black stretchy pencil skirt, some sunglasses, and a blue sheer shirt with no sleeves, which tied with a knot at the front. Sophie got a couple of t-shirts, a pair of sunglasses, and an oversized green leather purse. Back at home, we ripped the tags off our things, and she became agitated. She held up the purse. Oh my God, do you know how much this should have cost? 40 fucking pounds. She looked completely scandalized. They really are asking people to steal things, she said, sounding as if she was only starting to just to believe herself. After that, we stole more clothes from places where they were overpriced and desirable. We said things like, £100 for a pair of silk trousers? Who do they think they're kidding? And then we found ourselves brushing against furniture in our new trousers just to feel the silk against our skin. I usually didn't put on the clothes right away. I just took off the tags and hung the new items in my dresser, never wearing an entirely new outfit, but incorporating items one at a time into my wardrobe to delay the thrill of having new things for as long as possible. Later, we started stealing cigarettes because, well, what the hell did we owe the tobacco industry? I went through a stage of taking a different brand every time. I collected the boxes and displayed them in my bedroom like postcards. Of course, I wore my new outfits at work. There wasn't a sudden overnight change in my status, but I felt better, more confident. And as I had proved myself as not completely inept at my job, I was left mercifully to my own devices. I had begun to write the press releases for the exhibitions, a job that I was enjoying so much that I was in a rush to get back at lunchtime. This day, I went to Pret and picked up a sandwich to eat at my desk, crayfish with avocado. As I was eating, the doorbell rang. I pressed the intercom button to let the visitor into the gallery. When, after some seconds, we didn't hear the door open, Sandra left the office to see what the problem was. I continued writing. When she didn't come back straight away, I heard muffled voices, so I finished my sandwich and followed her in. Sandra was standing closely together with three police officers in high-vis bomber jackets. When I entered, all four turned to look at me. At once, it was an effort to breathe. I starting at my hands, what felt like pins and needles spread across my body, throbbing painfully. The jig was up. worse than being found out by one's parents who have a natural predilection for forgiveness. This was being discovered by the teacher who always thought you too arrogant anyway and had been waiting for the opportunity to prove that the world does not run according to your say-so. I think we can agree, officers, that being caught by her employee is punishment enough. They looked like they did not agree. For the price of a sandwich, I would say that it was hardly worth your time to prosecute. As if dismissed from a classroom, they filed slowly out of the door. Sandra motioned for me to follow her into the office. We sat facing each other on our office chairs. She looked at me for a very long time before starting to speak. I guess from the look on your face that this was not your first time, she said. I lowered my head. I took something once. You have to understand. I was still living with my husband back then and I felt like nothing I had was really mine. I looked up and noticed for the first time the milky blue of her eyes. I went into a department store and took a huge brown fur jacket from its hanger. I put it on and I left the store. The alarms went off, of course, and that poor security guard. When he asked to look in my bag, I reached myself to my grandest height. I was a dancer, you know, and fixed him with such a haughty stare that he apologized and went back inside. She laughed, a dirty, knowing laugh, and I could tell she must have been so beautiful once.
Gerdy is a New York-based author and architect born in Albania. His writing explores architecture as fiction through a filmic imagination, pushing literature into multiverse narrative. Set inside the tectonic grid of New York City, On the Rocks, his collection of short stories, amalgamations of stuntman action films, artistic distractions, architectural investigations, hip-hop axioms, cowboy westerns, travel guides, love stories. It is uncompromising in its aggressive structure and dead serious humor. These narratives are set against a series of drawings by line type that corroborate, interrogate, and surprise the narrative. Together, the two create a rich and textured inquiry into the geography of capitalist New York.
This one's called Laughter and Who Cares. It's written in the form of a play. Damn this conference room, especially in a New York hot summer. Sweaty bodies enter. The air conditioner burns wild noise. At the back of the room, off center, grins Mr. Marshall's cold, stern face. Broken by screens, cracked by divorces, lacerated by puerile convictions. An institutional man fed on technics, walking hand in hand with fear for a shadow. Tie clips and cufflinks shimmer ablaze, reflecting fluorescent epileptic rays from the ceiling. Dark mahogany lining, a surface illusion glued, a table too long for seamless wood. You can't find that in the Amazon rainforest. Whiskey trail on the right, amphetamine congestion on the left. Kicking Mr. Freepomp forward, the junkie marionette, a specter of yesterday's prostitute on the collar of his dark blue blazer. The fraternity party is still going. It's just better dressed and more powerfully equipped. The paddles turn to keyboards, to impossible debts. Oh, that Mr. Senev, can he ever keep his hands to himself? Pervert makes the animal porn industry look like child's play. My, how my imagination wanders in a room of greed. Sexual harassment is part of the territory in this gas chamber. Time to close the door and push the last straggler in the burning bush. Let's see if they melt. Mr. Marshall, this conference room has always had this absurd effect on my bladder. The sewers are calling my bowels. Guess it is only the first bell. Now I must induce to shit my guts out via imagination. Truly a puzzle how one can continue drinking a laxative. See and copy, the motto of every insecure individual. There's always taste. One must have taste, even if it's contradictory. Where the hell are they? Always late and bringing the proverbial doom of last night's end of days. The board. That's what keeps the checks and balances. That's what keeps the treadmill plugged in. Too bad the treadmill is theirs to run on. They keep it plugged in. And I keep their life expectancy, their children's, and their children's children. They institute their own surrender. Hegemony defined by oligarchy. Me being the a priori, they stuck in theory. One can only thank the Romans for the evolutionary line of people like me. keeping debt, privatizing debt, enjoying the suffering of generations. It's all in the protection of the law. Before that, people were being cheated, or rather owing things without tangible value. Now they don't own shit. The corporation is where everybody goes to blend, a conglomerate that can use the money, but it can make the money. And they enforce the law. I just have to sit here having indigestion waiting for something new. It takes knowledge to get to the bottom of it, and knowledge keeps fighting itself. Frankness becomes 2,000 pages. I've passed my younger days and my middle ages. I just roll the dice and have bowel movements waiting for a late board. Very rich men that cannot find happiness. That's it! Now I've embossed my scent in the furniture. You can't help gas, you gotta let it out. Funny, I once heard an oil man tell me that while creating an ecological catastrophe that will have a global effect on all bowel movements. Deep down, some people enjoy the smell of their own farts when they are alone. Strangely, they cannot seem to enjoy the same pleasure in the company of many. It works opposite for laughter. Most cannot laugh unless in company. They can chuckle, but they cannot prolong to be enthused. It messes with sanity. Looking insane in company is better than in private. That way, you know you have to take out. The guy in the corner with a furry brow looking out the window, not laughing. One can help but flatulate in those situations. Sitting next to a billionaire and saying, I violate your oxygen, kiss my ass. There was one time, long ago, when they had to let me go. I drank an extra large coffee in advance. You have to give it to the coffee companies. The extra large cups are for days when they have to let you go. You drink the coffee, eat a bagel with scallion cream cheese, smoke a cigarette, inhale deep, and you're fully loaded. Without mercy, they ramble and you fart. They will talk a long time trying to explain themselves out of it. You keep farting. You fart so much. You want to light a match. It's also a brilliant way to go out subtly, depending on if you get called out. I knew it. I was a small fry. Couldn't do anything about it. I was done for, but they would remember my ass on their nose. It's fulfilling enough just to make them squirm. Imagine an executive stopping their self-righteous speech to ask you if you just farted. In the hierarchy of the pyramid scheme, we still share the same air. That's why I'm not trying to live anymore. It's meetings like these where I await a mutiny, a true barrage of exploding asses to suffocate my existence. I will hold it in and wait for them in the early morning lumbagos, the latter-day pagans that can't pee straight. There is Denver now, letting in last night. There goes Senev, all touchy, squandering discipline for schoolboy Phillips. This is what I have to work with, a comedy of incestuous thinking and perverted old bastards who could give two shits about collapsing four economies as long as they get to do whatever they want. It's as much a waste as a word. What puts them around this table is their sixth sense. Oh yes, that abnormal tick, that green demon, greed. Mr. Olden. I wonder where this old man is going to be 1 hour from now. A sunshiny day can always strike you with too much goodness. A ray will be enough to get this old vampire inside the cave for his final nap. Strange that a meeting should be called so randomly on short notice. They're probably gonna fire someone. Damn, I fucked up on that merger last month. That was true molten gold, a volcano of wealth. Never really had a friend in life. My wife doesn't count. She married me for that reason. Marriage is the pigeonhole of all facades. The mass reverse engineer and you're left with brains transmitting neurons attempting to understand how the relationship went from friendship to something else. Not going to have any crutches if they let me go. Might end up killing myself. Seems the only plausible conclusion outside this lifestyle. But wait, I never did go get myself checked out. 9 psychopaths and a warlord. I sure really remember craving to be this as a child. Wanted to be a money handler. A real American gangster is what I became. Shivering in my boots on the battlefield, thinking suicide. I'm not built to suffer. I don't preserve. I steal and I parasite. Contrary to this, I still win. Long gone are the days of heroes and anti-heroes. No, now we celebrate the obsolete in the shadows. Sometimes I feel as if I keep forgetting something, and that something I know is unimportant, but because I have forgotten, it becomes important. It's the what will I do in that situation. Let's say I kill myself. How will these fools react? Unimpressed? With contempt? Another dead company man, that's all? We can fill that vacancy instantly. I wonder how I would have held up in the Middle Ages. Perhaps I might have survived the plague. It's the butterfly moments that save you. Imagine the fisherman outside Hiroshima looking at the cloud, witnessing annihilation on the edge. He chose to go fishing that day, and I chose to walk into this room, as I chose to be strangled last night. The rules are I need to make money, and that's it. A pain keeps tapping my knees. Mr. Marshall. Good day, gentlemen. Thank you for arriving so late. It gave me time to really prepare for this conference. What new things are there to say? The indivisible power of this company is... Mr. Freepump. The best part is I had to sit here while the boss takes a nip of the good stuff. I can smell it from over here. Age McCallan, what boss? I can take this company out of hands in minutes, and he can crush me with the whisper. If I could change things, I would become a porcupine man or a turtle man or wear a robot suit at all times. Mr. Olden looks broken down, nervous stick on the nostril, tap tap on the table, the overlooking glance. I bet he hasn't been home for a week. Beard and sweat, a complacent cow waiting to get slaughtered. You know I love a good burger. Wonder how many burgers you can get from one cow. What else is new? Serious people can deceive you. Sometimes it's better to say the faces of ignorant people looking serious. Olden is the guy that will panic and decide to be the killer for fear of being killed. Most people die of natural causes. Some die of natural stupidity. Life is like diabetes. Don't make it too sweet. Mr. Olden. Now wait a minute. Who does the jackoff think he's talking to? I had nothing to do with the loss of the Adams Jefferson deal. You better back off or... Continually conniving that Mr. Billows, can't figure out which of these bastards is licking their chops and who's taking a piss out of me. Well, I have a briefcase if I can't blow these faces away. Really, what do we put in these briefcases nowadays? Free Pump over there has got something up his sleeve. Mr. Geith, better put the noose on this quack, cut his feet from under him. Tired of these lame weak, I made it to the top guys who think there's not going to be competition. There's no slack. I'll cut your throat. Coolness is only cool in the wake of an adversary, and if you ask me, Mr. Marshall looks like a general in his last stupor of alcohol's inhibition. Can't help but love it. The Maverick is the only playing card. Half the men in this room are testing what to do with their college degrees. The class shift allows a ruthless nobody like me to congregate level-eyed with these aristocratic lineages. That's what they are, these tubs of lard, the pink face, puffy cheek, booze delirium. Too bad I can't relate, so I'll cut your throat. My ancestors worked for theirs, and so did I. Mr. Olden, you fear guys like me taking the genealogy of your ancestors and using it to wipe my ass. It shouldn't astonish or make you edgy that severity welcomes comfort. You took that comfort and made a blanket to hide under. It's due time to bring about the picture perfect. Self-immolation always makes you wonder who holds power outside the frame, the devil or the soul. Mr. Artem, something to do with waste removal. Strange thing to let out of the bag when this company only deals with waste removal. Gotta fit in till the white hair spills the beans. New ideas are recycled ones that can finally be applied. Ahead of its time, can only find consensus in practice when the right players bring the suppliers up to date. Insider trading is legal if you make it complicated enough. The law needs to do some problem solving to catch up with time. But who wants to deal with that? Steal everything. Never have a top guy, main guy, president, or CEO. Be the guy in the shadows. The angle man, who loses nothing, controls everything, and never gets the finger. Dirty hands and clean shaven. The no fame, no problems approach. You can't do that unless you understand everything and have practiced all things. Mr. Marshall occupies my thrones. The basics are. It's only a matter of time before I know what we're exporting. Mr. Senev.
Asleep upon two Russian prostitutes. That's where I ought to be. Fulfilling daily obligations represses the libido. I'm sure Attila could stop an army to make love to his wives. I should have a surrogate other, like the Husseins. Restraint does lead to better orgasms. The silly future of college graduates is to land upon my lap. That's how you know the difference between a New Yorker and the rest of the world. The rest of the world falls prey to their sense of adventure, which is nothing other than an amusement park sexcapade.
Launch party this tonight at from 8:30 to 10 p.m. here at Basel. Visit us at montez.com.